In the years since the ceasefire that ostensibly ended the Korean War in July 1953, four U.S. soldiers have slipped across the DMZ, the demilitarized zone, into North Korea. Crossing the line tells the story of the only one of those defectors who's still alive, James Joseph Dresnok. The film opens today at Cinema Village, and its director, Daniel Gordon, joins me now. I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show. Hello.
Hello. How are you?
The North Korean government hasn't allowed many journalists to come into their country or to travel freely, but you seem to have had almost unlimited access to Joe Dresnok. How did that happen?
Well, it's come through a period of, I guess, 6 years of filming in North Korea. This is our third film that we've made. We made one in 2002 called The Game of Their Lives, which is about their soccer team. And we never set out to do it this way, but it's kind of how it's turned out. Because we started with a relatively neutral story and a feel-good story for the North Koreans, they then trusted us to go a little bit deeper into their society, and we made A State of Mind a couple of years later, which was following two schoolgirl gymnasts as they performed the mass games. From then, we were able to gain the trust again to go a lot deeper than we ever thought was possible, and that's to meet and then interview and film the life of Joe Dresnok.
I would have thought that A State of Mind, which I've seen, would have freaked them out because it kind of showed these girls to be almost automatons. But I guess that was a compliment in their minds.
Yeah, I mean, they were kind of like the perfect communists, really. Although to a Western audience, they also showed some individuality that you didn't quite realize was possible in North Korea, you know, and they were individuals, and sometimes they lied to their parents, and sometimes they played hooky instead of going to the mass game. So there were sort of inklings that this is actually not that dissimilar to us.
Were you given total freedom in this case? Because you seem to be able to move freely around Pyongyang.
Yeah, I mean, it's freedom's kind of a relative concept in North Korea. We've never been refused any permission to go and film what we want to film. Most locations are fixed before we go out there, but we are given the flexibility that if one day we say, well, we've got to go to wherever, be that Joe's workplace or a drinking bar, whatever, we've got to go there, we've got to do it now. For us, that means that we tend to kind of not catch them unawares, but we know that this is actually reality rather than it's, you know, a propaganda piece performed for us.
What led you to Joe Dresnok's story?
Well, we found out about it when we were doing the football film, the soccer film, The Game of Their Lives, and someone just said, you know, there's Americans who live in North Korea, and I mean, it was just the most ludicrous concept that you could imagine. I just thought it was too bizarre to be true.
Well, 21 POWs chose to stay in North Korea after the ceasefire, but Joe Dresnok and three others are the only ones who actually chose to cross into
exactly.
the country.
And I mean, those POWs in the Korean War then went to China. So as far as sort of going to North Korea and staying there were only these four, and there was a lot of misinformation out there. I mean, there was a total lack of information. Once they went and did their pieces of propaganda for the North Koreans in the first few years, sort of beyond the mid-60s, you never heard from them again. And as far as the Western world was concerned, they'd gone and disappeared and had probably been shot, you know. And I mean, I guess it was the equivalent of sort of... it would have been easier to interview Joe Dresnok on the moon than it would have been to interview Joe Dresnok in North Korea. And so to actually get him was far and away the most bizarre day, you know, in my sort of young filmic career.
Your film felt to me like a psychological study of a man with a damaged soul. What was your take on Joe Dresnok?
I think that's quite accurate. I thought he was a very complex character. And certainly, initially I was drawn to him because it was like, what on earth possessed you to defect to North Korea, and especially in 1962, just 9 years after the Korean War. But then the more I got into his story, the more I was interested in what happened to him afterwards rather than the split-second decision to cross.
But well, actually, before and after, because well, much of the story has to do with the life he led before he chose to defect.
Which is a tragic life. And the one thing I was concerned about was that, was he exaggerating? From the relative comfort of North Korea, you know, is he exaggerating the life that he had in America in order to justify his actions? And he had a horrible childhood and not a brilliant early life in the army.
Abandoned by his family, in effect.
And then he felt abandoned by the army as well. And also he married and you know, he was divorced. His wife cheated on him while he was serving in West Germany. So this whole sort of tragic life led him to do it. But
and he was also faced with a court-martial for going AWOL. Yeah. This is a man who had problems taking orders.
Sure.
So he winds up in North Korea, where you only have to take orders.
Which is the most ridiculous thing ever. And you know, try to defect from North Korea to seek asylum at the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union decided that they didn't want to accept the Americans. And so that was when I think Joe Dresnok decided, I can't run away anymore and face up to his life. And that's what fascinated me.
Well, he tried to get out. And as you say, the Soviets wouldn't just hand them back to North Korean authorities. But what do you think he thought he was doing when he defected? Did he think he was going to go into a better situation? He must have been told by the military that North Korea was a kind of a paranoid state.
I don't think he was thinking particularly clearly that August day in 1962 when you know, he had he was awaiting a court-martial. He knew his life in the army was finished. And, I mean, as he put it quite succinctly, there's only one place to run, and that's to go north. And if you're going to run away, go north. Now, the consequences, you know, I'll deal with the consequences when I get there. And I don't think he quite realized what he was letting himself in for.
Although it was rather dangerous. The DMZ was a lot more dangerous and violent, I think, than most people realized for all the years after the war.
And myself, I was staggered to find out from one of the soldiers that we spoke to that they'd lost the original plans for the minefields. So no one actually knew where they'd been laid on the American side, never mind on the North Korean side. So for him to walk through that minefield.
He's just lucky, obviously. Otherwise, he would have blown up. Now, you say he left with little thought about the future. Was that typical of the other people who also defected?
Yeah, there was no ideological bone, I think, in any of the bodies of the four American defectors. I think they were, in for various reasons, just getting out of a situation that they didn't want to find themselves in and didn't really have any other plan other than to defect, and they really had to deal with the situation once they got to North Korea.
And what did the North Koreans expect of them, do you think?
Well, they were low ranking, so they didn't expect any great secrets from them. So initially they just decided to use them in relatively small scale propaganda. They'd get on the loudspeakers and urge other American soldiers to defect. They were in, you know, propaganda publications, they delivered pamphlets, that kind of thing. And again, we were amazed when we found some of these. And a lot of the soldiers, the US soldiers who served in the DMZ, had sort of found them fluttering down, and it was illegal to keep them. But of course, they put them down their pants and, you know, took them back to America and kept them as, you know, little trophies. But it was weird, actually. The North Koreans, you'd think, once they realized they had no use for these Americans, you'd think they'd get rid of them. But they didn't. They kept them there and tried to give them a place in society.
My guest is the Daniel Gordon, who's made a film called Crossing the Line, which opens today at Cinema Village, about the only living American defector to North Korea. Joe Dresnok also acted in some North Korean films. After he decided that he couldn't get out, I guess he thought he'd make the best of a bad situation and wound up living a pretty decent life, don't you think?
I think so. I think if he'd have gone back to America, he'd have been chucked out of the army. He'd have that dishonor with him forever. He was quite prone to drinking and fighting as well. And so I guessed he would probably have ended up in jail for some point in his life.
Instead, he appears in several North Korean films, including a 20-part series called Unsung Heroes as an American villain. He becomes a celebrity.
Absolutely.
As a result.
And everyone, his character name is Arthur in that film, and everyone knows in North Korea as Arthur. This is nearly 30 years afterwards. Everyone calls him Arthur. And he found fame playing American villains throughout his life and putting the uniform back on, which I just find is the most ironic thing. Putting the uniform on and acting like an evil American and, you know, getting fame out of it.
He's a very large guy, so in North Korea, he towers over everyone. He probably weighs about 250 pounds
at least. Yeah, he's huge. He's 6'5", and he's a big guy. I wouldn't want to get on the wrong side of him.
He also translated some of Kim Il-sung's writings into English, although he's not the most educated English speaker.
No, I mean, what he would have done would have been to get the the works would be translated by Korean into English, and they would show him and say, is this correct? But again, the irony being that he didn't, I think he quit 8th or 9th grade, and none of the soldiers, none of the defectors went beyond the 9th grade. They all dropped out of high school, and yet they all ended up as English teacher at the University of Foreign Language.
So is that something they had in common, that they were all rather uneducated?
Yeah, absolutely.
Anything else they had in common? Because he seems to be the one who adjusted best. They all tried to assimilate.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think him and Parrish, but Parrish died 12 years ago. They seem to have assimilated. They managed to get with the language, that they got a relatively good understanding of Korean, and Dresnok speaks Korean now. You know, and you forget as well, you think, oh, he's been there 40 years. He was only in America for 20. And so he must have, adapted in some way. But he did seem to have been better able to adapt. I think Jenkins was a lot more awkward as a character, both in America and in North Korea. And Absher, who was the first across, seemed to me to be fairly simple in his ways. So kind of went with the flow, but again, didn't find it easy.
Dresnok married twice. Jenkins married a woman who'd been kidnapped from Japan.
That was, again, the kind of twists that came up in the film and during the course of research. The North Koreans admitted in 2002 that actually kidnapped 13 Japanese nationals, taken them to North Korea and made them teach Japanese to spies. And one of these ended up, after 2 years of clearly not been able to teach spies, ended up being introduced to Jenkins, and they got married within 6 weeks, which is a strange courtship. But I guess when you're a foreigner in North Korea and you've been brought against your will, and Jenkins was there as well, it kind of served a purpose for everyone. So they ended up getting married and having two children.
And she eventually was repatriated to Japan, and he went over to join her eventually after some deal was struck. And he claimed that the North Korean government had cut his tattoos off without his consent.
Yeah.
That was a kind of an odd complaint. Joe Dresnok says that he cut off his own tattoos. Yeah. Is there some problem with tattoos in North Korea?
Well, it wasn't the tattoos so much. It was the fact that they had U.S. on them. Both of them had U.S. tattoos. Dresnok had a paratrooper. Jenkins had the cross rifles. And they said they cut the U.S. out. But actually, Dresnok had a huge tattoo of a naked woman, which he felt was inappropriate in Korea, which is true. It was inappropriate in South Korea, never mind in North Korea. But, they seemed to just... It would probably have been suggested to them that it was inappropriate, and then the extent to which it was cut out, as in the permissions given, I think you make your own decision up. But certainly it's a strange one, because it suits Jenkins to say that he was forced to have him cut off, because it makes you sympathetic to him, especially when he's facing court-martial. And with Dresnok, you could say he's forced to say it because he's still living in North Korea.
Now, Dresnok obviously not only speaks Korean, but probably spoke Korean to his kids, because although his sons look very Western, and I think the North Koreans consider them Americans, though they think of themselves as Koreans, they speak English with a Korean accent.
And that was the strangest thing, to see a North Korean university. And obviously, I've been to North Korea 20 or so times, and I've been to that university many, many times, and only ever seen classes with, you know, Korean students. And to walk in and see this lesson, and suddenly there's like this white boy that just looks like me, and he's speaking what I think is perfect Korean, and then I talk English with him, and he's speaking with a Korean accent. And it's the strangest thing, because visually, you don't think this should happen. And
his mother's not a Korean either. His mother
is we understood her to be Romanian, and it was never fully explained. But the allegations at the moment are that she was another woman that was kidnapped and forced to go to North Korea. But yeah, I'm assuming that Korean was spoken in the family home, because their standard of English isn't the best.
Joe is very proud of his sons, and obviously he saw them as an opportunity to be a better father than his own father had been to him. And he kind of brags that he was never forced to cut down on food during the time of the North Korean famine, when so many people died of malnutrition. He doesn't see anything odd. I guess he just sees himself as somebody who was given a privileged situation.
Yeah, I think he said that really more from a gratitude to the government that they kept feeding him rather than their own people. And that kind of showed, you know, the esteem in which he was held. But I still think he lives a relatively ordinary life for a North Korean citizen. A citizen of Pyongyang, by definition, is privileged because you're in the capital. But, you know, the apartment that he's in is average to below average, in my experience. I've seen much worse, but I've seen much better.
If he had been some party official, he would have had a much nicer place.
I'm sure, yeah. You know, the two relatively small bedrooms and a very, very small bathroom and a small lounge is not a big, you know, big apartment by any stretch.
Although he comes across as being relatively satisfied, he obviously is kind of unhappy. He refuses to heed doctor's orders despite some serious health problems. You almost feel like he's killing himself passively by drinking and smoking.
I think that might be a trait that's applied to many of us. I don't know. He's I don't think that's a reflection on his life. I think he does what he wants to do, and you know, he likes to drink and he likes to smoke, and no one's going to tell him what to do, whether that's good for his health or not.
Are you a rare example of him having some contact with the outside world?
Yeah, I think unique. I don't think he'd spoken, apart from the other Americans and the very occasional, Westerner that he'd come into contact with, when we were the only ones that, since 1962, that he'd spoken to.
So he has absolutely no communication with the family back in
absolutely
the States?
Absolutely none. No.
Because he had a good relationship with his brother.
Yeah, and, well, he had, I don't know about a good relationship, but he had a relationship until they were, I think, six, and then they were split up, and he's kind of never forgotten him and really wants to get in touch with him. But I know that I've tried to put them together, but the brother doesn't seem to be all that keen.
The North Korean government is often described as paranoid. Do you see him that way?
In my experience, not. One of the lasting comments that I remember was from the ambassador to Britain, and he said to me the thing that he loved about a state of mind was that, you know, he said, you know, the North Koreans say this, the West say that, and you allowed the audience to make its own mind up, and that's magnificent. And I thought that's really strange for a politician from North Korea to not say, why don't you show our point of view more often? And the North Koreans we work with just appreciate that we're being honest with them. And with our portrayal of the society, that it may not be a perfect and what they want the world to see, but we're not, you know, just telling out and out lies.
So that means you'll be making more films in North Korea?
I would really like my marriage to last, and so I'm spending a bit more time at home.
But that it is a privileged situation.
Absolutely.
To be able to be a Westerner who can go to North Korea simply because nobody else gets access to
and
it.
And it's a very addictive place to go to once you have that access. So I don't doubt in any way that I'll be back, but I'm just giving it a rest for a year or so.
Daniel Gordon's film Crossing the Line opens today at the Cinema Village. Thank you so much for being with us.
My absolute pleasure.